From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Sundown Friday marks the start of Passover, when Jews gather at the table to retell the story of their exodus from Egypt. The Haggadah is their guide for the Seder, the traditional Passover meal and meditation. There have been thousands of translations of the Haggadah and the story it tells. Now, celebrated writers Jonathan Safran Foer and Nathan Englander have added theirs. This hour, On Point, the story of freedom and its meaning in Jonathan Safran Foer and Nathan Englander's new American Haggadah. Joining us now from New York is first writer Nathan Englander, raised an Orthodox Jew. He now describes himself as a God-fearing atheist, author of The Ministry of Special Cases, and For the Relief of Unbearable Urges. His latest collection of stories is What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank. He's the translator of the new American Haggadah. Nathan Englander, welcome. Great to have you.
Oh, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And with us from New York is Jonathan Safran Foer. He's been called one of the most original writers of his generation, author of Everything is Illuminated and Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. He is editor of the New American Haggadah, the one who got the project off the ground. Jonathan Safran Foer, welcome back to On Point. Wonderful to have you today.
Hi, it's great to be back.
Jonathan, let me start with you, if I may. We'll have people who are deep in the midst of preparation for exactly this evening of ritual and remembrance, and others who really aren't familiar with what goes on at a Passover Seder and the role of the Haggadah in it. What is the Haggadah, Jonathan?
Well, to begin with, Passover is the most celebrated Jewish holiday. It occurs on consecutive nights in the spring in America, and it's the annual retelling of the story of the Exodus. It's a story that is one of the oldest continually told stories and most familiar across cultures. Whether you're Jewish or not, you probably know about the 10 plagues, the parting of the Red Sea, and Moses leading the Jews out of Egypt. And so the Haggadah is the sort of guidebook for this retelling. Families gather, and not only Jewish families. I mean, you know, they're hosted by Jewish families, but when I was a kid, we would have over family friends as well, teachers from high school, and partake in or reenact, and in the most ideal version, be characters within this story. And the Haggadah is the guidebook for the evening. It not only leads us through the retelling, but also the sort of ritualistic obligations and the songs as well.
Nathan Englander, what about it? It is, I guess the direct translation is kind of the narration, the telling of a story, but it's also a guide to thinking about the story, and I guess the rituals are part of that. What about that role of the Haggadah, Nathan?
Oh, I just, you know, it's the wonderful quote Jonathan chose for the cover, you know, which is basically in every generation, we have to tell the stories if we are the ones that are leaving Egypt, and I think it's the most interactive story there is, you know, in our world of, you know, video games and, you know, where touch screens. It's this idea where the meal is part of the story. And, I mean, there's people who literally, I think it's a Sephardi tradition that's moving over to the Ashkenazi world, people who literally march around the table, you know, with matzah thrown over their shoulder as if they're the ones leaving Egypt. And I think it's, you know, it's just, again, a retelling that is both active in the telling and this beautiful physical interaction with story that's so rare.
So, Jonathan, we're at the table. It's Passover evening. It's the Seder, and there will be a meal, and it will have particular elements to that meal to help remember the bitterness of enslavement and the joy of freedom. And what? So, traditionally, the Haggadah would be at the table, on the table, probably wine stained if it's been used more than a few years, and right in the middle of what's going on, Jonathan.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as a novelist, I should say, whenever I give a reading and do a signing afterwards, nothing makes me happier than seeing a book that is beaten up.
Yeah.
You know, a book that looks like it was dropped in the bathtub and read on a train and eaten upon and is heavily underlined. You want your books to be used.
Right.
And there's no book that more wants to be used and, in fact, demands to be used than a Haggadah. So not only in the sense of it being an artifact at the table, being the only book that I know of that is we are supposed to read in one sitting while we eat a meal, but also that, you know, as I was saying earlier, demands this kind of radical leap of empathy, not just that we are the retellers of the story, but that we see ourselves in it, that we literally feel as if we are ourselves being freed from Egypt.
Nathan, give us a sense, anywhere you like in your translation here, give us some reading just so we can get a sense of the cadence and message of the Haggadah.
Oh, that is a good challenge. I can just...
Right from
I
the top, if you like.
Oh, start at the top. I can actually, I'll read the translation of that quote. that we've been discussing, that we've touched upon twice. In every generation, a person is obligated to view himself as if he were the one who went out from Egypt, as it is said, and on that day tell your son, saying, for this purpose the Lord labored on my behalf by taking me out of Egypt. It was not our fathers alone who were delivered by the Holy One, blessed is he. We were also delivered with them, as it is said, and he took us out from there in order to bring us, to give us, the land that he pledged to our fathers.
Nathan Englander from the New Translation. Nathan, you're famously from a strict kind of Orthodox upbringing, but then really walked away from a lot of that. How do you translate a holy text like this from your position as I've seen you describe yourself as a God-fearing atheist? How's that work?
That is an excellent question. So excellent. I asked it to myself many, many times when Jonathan brought me the project. Yes, I mean, that's the strange thing. Again, we often don't have distance from ourselves because, you know, when I walked away from religion, I walked so far, I walked right to Jerusalem, which was a strange place to leave that. But again, this project has totally changed me. You know, I'm too old. I'm 42 years old. It's too old to have a chip on my shoulder and, you know, be angry about something or be distant. But there's a separate matter of feeling fine with things and balanced in your life and not necessarily wanting to go back to a certain place. When Jonathan brought this project to me, I was very resistant and I learned a big lesson from it because he said, you know, I'd never interacted with the English side and he sent me home. He said, you know what, just go look at it. Go look at the English and look at the text that you haven't, you know, looked at in that way in a long time. And I opened right to the Havdalah, the part, you know, this thing, we'll actually be saying it this year. When a Seder falls on a Saturday night, you say this prayer, Hamavdil ben Kodesh leKodesh, is a line in it. Basically, we differentiate between the Sabbath and the holiday. Mm-hmm. And I looked at that line, I read it in Hebrew, Hamavdil ben Kodesh leKodesh, and I looked at the English, and it's a very clear, accurate translation in the Haggadah. I opened to separate between the Sabbath and the holiday. But what the Hebrew says, actually, is to separate between holy and holy. And just as someone who loves books and loves language, I thought, you know, as an obligation to text, I thought, my God, someone has made this thing clear in its usage so that we understand what's being separated from. But, you know, it's one thing, this space between holy and holy to me was so metaphysical, so infinite, so gigantic and philosophical and literary on all these fronts that seeing the loss of it in English, I thought there is a job for me here as someone who's dedicated his life to books and language to just simply try and keep fealty to the text. And again, it really has changed the way I think about this book and my interaction with my past as a whole.
Jonathan Safran Foer, we've talked with you about many of your books, and now you come to this one. As you point out, it's been translated many, many times. I mean, what was the need you saw? Was it a personal need to get engaged in a new way with this text? Was it a need to close metaphysical loopholes you saw in the common English versions used in the United States? What drove you?
I don't know if need is the right word. It felt more like an opportunity. I have been to 68 Seders in my life, and they have all generated really wonderful conversations and ultimately generated wonderful memories. It's not that I felt that they were failed experiences in some way, but, you know, the opportunity to gather with one's family and extended family and, you know, friends and teachers to talk about these most important of all themes, you know, who is a slave, who is free, what are the obligations of free people to slaves, how do we measure ourselves as individuals, as families, and as a people against our ideals, you know, that is a really magnificent opportunity, and it is more than bittersweet when the potential isn't fulfilled, isn't realized. And given the centrality of the Haggadah in this experience, it's very hard to transcend the Haggadah, or at least it's hard for Jews who aren't, you know, who don't grow up with a certain level of Jewish literacy. I did think, you know, especially looking around my particular Seder table where half the people are writers, you know, why are we accepting a book that doesn't feel like a good fit for us? You know, it might very well be a good fit for someone else, but it didn't feel like a good fit for us. So I thought, here's an opportunity to work on a project that will, you know, enhance my family's conversation and bring it closer to what we crave.
And what do you mean a good fit for us? Do you mean your family? Do you mean American Jews? Do you mean young American Jews? Who wasn't the traditional translation fitting in your view, Jonathan?
Well, it's not just the translation, it's the entire framing of the liturgy. So the liturgy is ancient. You know, it's more than 3,000 years old. It's been retold by more than 100 generations of Jews. When we talk about making a new Haggadah, what we're really talking about is how we frame it. you know, the way that it's translated into English, the way that there are commentaries that might be springboards for family conversations, and also any other techniques for contextualizing the book. So with this Haggadah, we found through the design a way of telling the story of Hebrew lettering, Hebrew handwriting and typography through the ages. With a timeline that runs graphically across the top of the pages, we found a way of contextualizing the story itself. You know, how has the story of the Exodus appeared through Jewish history and through world history? And then with the commentaries, we hope to not offer prescriptions, but provocative questions that families could then use as a starting point for the real business of the Seder, which is not reading a book, but conversing.
And those questions woven all through this new translation. Nathan Englander did the translating work. Jonathan Safran Foer, the editor of New American Haggadah. They're with us today from New York. Listeners, you can join us this hour. Whatever your faith, do you know this story of Moses and the Pharaoh, of parting the Red Sea, of fleeing slavery in Egypt to freedom? Can you hear in this new translation the power of that story, the search for meaning? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Kulanu mesubim, halala ze, halala ze, kulanu mesubim.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Jonathan Safran Foer and Nathan Englander, celebrated writers, about their new translation of the great Jewish story of freedom as told in the Haggadah. It is the text, the guide for Passover observance and celebration at the Seder meal. They join us today from New York. Their translation is out and getting a lot of attention. They've been making the rounds. Jonathan Safran Foer spoke with Stephen Colbert last month about the new Haggadah. Of course, Colbert was Colbert.
Didn't this story already exist? It's called Exodus.
Yeah, it's
so you think you can improve on Moses? You got some matzo balls, buddy.
Yeah.
Jonathan Safran Foer, I'm sure in so many words, Stephen Colbert's not the only one to have put that to you. I mean, what about those who say, look, we've got 7,000 translations. You know, where do you get the chutzpah to come up with one more? What's your response?
You know, the fact of there being 7,000 almost implies that there's no chutzpah involved. There is no book that has been revisited or revised more times than this book. If you were to think, what's a book I might, you know, invest myself in making a new version of? This is literally the least original of all choices you could make. There's something about the story that compels revisiting, not only because it's such a rich and dramatic and vibrant and well-known story, but because of this imperative to keep it contemporary. You know, the Seder is a failure and the Haggadah is a failure if we, sitting around the table in the year 2012 with all of the, you know, emotional and political and intellectual and psychological baggage that we bring to it, don't feel as if it's telling our story. So, you know, how can we do that? I think that it's hard to imagine one version one version of this timeless book ever sustaining itself over time.
Nathan Englander, read us more. Whatever you like. We want to get a feeling for your translation.
Here it goes, then. Were our mouths filled with a singing like the sea, and our tongues awash with song as waves countless, and our lips lauding as the skies are wide, and our eyes illumined like the sun and the moon, and our hands spread out like the eagles of heaven, and our feet as fleet as fawns, still we would not suffice in thanking you, Lord God of us and God of our fathers, in blessing your name for even one of a thousand thousands from the thousands of thousands and the 10,000s of 10,000s of times you did good turns for our fathers and for us.
Wow, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. We can hear you rising in your translation to the passion of the text itself. What was easy for you in this job, Nathan, and what was most difficult?
The easiest part was doing the whole translation in the first few weeks. It took maybe 6 weeks. I had the whole thing down. It's not long when you take the pictures out. But the hardest part was then recognizing the true obligation. I think this happened to all of us, to, you know, Daniel Handler, Lemony Snicket, and Jonathan and Oded, who did the beautiful design. Everyone, I think, thought this was, you know, that was, and again, it was much like writing fiction, where you force a story and then you recognize you have to listen to the story that's there. And I think what came over us all was the understanding of the true obligation to this text. You mentioned my irreligious irreligiosity, mm-hmm. but it's that idea that's not an immorality. I mean, I may be immoral in many ways, but when it comes to writing, that I consider it a moral act. And it was, I just suddenly thought, people are going to be praying to God with this book. This is their access to the ancient text, and I have this grave responsibility. There's this guy, Baruch Thaler, who grew up Hasidic, Lubavitcher Hasidic, and finished his smicha, and that is now a very secular, artsy person who's, you know, learned both worlds. He understands literature and, you know, Western thought and religious thought, and I thought a traditional text demands study in a traditional form, and I bumped into this guy. I'd been waiting for him, really, and I asked him if he would study with me, and we sat there, and we did it old school style, which is to argue every word, every sentence, to, you know, not just to trace a line back through Haggadot, but back to the Mishnah and the Gemara, back to the Torah, to see, you know, the words, they just echo and reference out. You really need to understand all their meanings before you choose one meaning.
And you mentioned the commentaries here, traditionally woven through the Haggadah. You have four people giving you commentary here: Nathaniel Deutsch, Jeffrey Goldberg, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, and Lemony Snicket, as you say. Jonathan, what's the role of the commentaries woven through the direct translation?
The role is to inspire a certain kind of questioning, a certain kind of vigorous conversation. You know, the real work at a Seder takes place at the Seder table, not in the Haggadah. The real work is not done by Nathan or Nathaniel Deutsch or Lemony Snicket or Jeffrey Goldberg. It's done by the family. But we need help to do the work. You know, we need to have some assistance, be pointed in what might be good or productive directions. So the goal with the commentaries was really twofold. One, to reveal the depth of the document itself, of the liturgy, that no matter what perspective you choose, no matter how hard you push on it, it will always offer up meaning, always offer up questions, also to stimulate some very specific questions. You know, when I was working with the different commentators, I said the most important things were to conceal your voice as much as possible, to not have this be, to not have the heavy hand of a creator, so that as much space is left for the user, but also not to be prescriptive. You know, the best commentaries are the ones that suggest the best questions rather than presents an argument or even a specific idea.
You say in the foreword to this Haggadah, your Haggadah, that the Seder is a protest against despair. Nathan, we hear that already in what you were reading, in the sort of glory of that worship. But tell us more about the protest against despair. What do you mean? What does that mean?
Oh, God. I mean, that's, you know, it's really... I guess I grew up, I've transferred all this part of my life to my writing, and I think about it all the time. I basically now translate everything into fiction. That's how I make sense of the world. Mm-hmm. But there's things, you know, the calendar. I knew I had to be in here at a specific time on a specific date on the calendar. I know it's April this month, but then there's sacred time and sacred space. There are these rhythms of the world and of the seasons, which is maybe why it's so unsettling to have a good, you know, 90 degree February day in New York. But there used to be seasons. Tell your children about them. But this idea to take it that there's time set into the year that no matter what you're doing, no matter what's happening in your life, to sit down and really to take stock. I mean, it's part of, you know, what comes up a lot is the choice of God of us in my translation instead of our God. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people really want to know about that. And I thought, because we actually, you know, even this thing, as Jonathan says, with his, you know, more than 60 seders, where you can say things year after year and they lose their meaning in a sense, not because you don't mean them, but because you have to stop and look at the language. And God of us made me think, you know, it's one word in Hebrew, and to split it into our God splits it into a phrase with some sense of ownership, maybe, that could get lost, as opposed to we are serving God. And this whole book, you know, to sit with it, I'm so thankful, even just for the way I love all text, to have gotten to spend an afternoon on a word, I say, but to see how much it's really just about thanks. This book is so much, is there food on your table? It really puts, for me, it really made me think about my own life, putting everything back in perspective. You know, as I said about the writing life, I'm just thankful, whatever other fears you have, like, do I have food on my table, a roof over my head, and do I have a pen and paper? Like, to recognize, what do you really want in this world?
Jonathan, what about those elements? I mean, there is that celebration of freedom. There is that thanks. There's that deliverance from slavery. And there is also, as you write in the foreword, the protest against despair. What's the balance here? How are they expressed?
I think through these sort of simultaneous movements, one toward recognition, you know, of the brokenness of the world, making sure that we are open-eyed enough, recognizing who is still a slave, recognizing the slavery in our own lives, and also recognizing ways in which we ourselves might, you know, be contemporary pharaohs, or at least not participants in this perpetual movement toward freedom, but also a kind of wonderful hopefulness or aspiration. You know, the Seder, the sort of grand finale of the Seder is when we say next year in Jerusalem. And, you know, it's a metaphorical Jerusalem, a Jerusalem of a world where there are fewer slaves of any kind anywhere, a Jerusalem in which we are closer approximations of the people we imagined ourselves being. I think it's, you know, some people, I have talked to an awful lot of people in the course of putting this book together, mm-hmm. and I've heard a lot of people say the Seder ends with what feels like a bit of a downer, you know, the recognition that of the full brokenness of the world. And other people say, God, I end up feeling kind of ecstatic at the end because of being reminded of the possibility of change. And ultimately, it has to be both of those things.
Jews have been sustained by that for many, many generations, as you say. Not only Jews. It's interesting. I've got some tape here from Martin Luther King Jr. This was the day before his assassination. That was 44 years ago today. He spoke in Memphis, and he said there that if God had asked him in which age he would like to live, he would start, in effect, in the midst of this story, in Egypt.
I would take my mental flight by Egypt, and I would watch God's children in their magnificent trek from the dark dungeons of Egypt through, or rather, to cross the Red Sea through the wilderness on toward the Promised Land.
On toward the Promised Land. Nathan Englander and Jonathan Safran Foer brought us a new American Haggadah, the telling of that story. They join us from New York. You can join us as well. Let's turn to our listeners. Galila is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Galila, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi.
My
question is, I've read this story many times, but I never really clearly understood the race of the people who were enslaved and why they were enslaved, and if it was anything like the slavery we've had in America.
The race of the people enslaved in Egypt, why they were enslaved, and was it anything like slavery in America? Jonathan?
Well, there are two ways to understand the story. One is literally, and one is as a story that sustained itself and provided inspiration for humans over the last several thousand years. You know, in the story itself, we're told that the Jews were enslaved by the Egyptians. Pretty straightforwardly, and that Moses came as the redeemer of the Jews. And through this narrative that includes the 10 plagues, the Jews found their freedom. But to me, what's a lot more interesting is the sustaining power of the story and the motivating power of the story. It's not just Martin Luther King. He's borrowed from or appealed to or referenced the exodus of the Jews. Gandhi did it. Almost every social justice movement of the 20th century has done it. And the story is a universal story. You know, it is Jews in the story who are liberated from Egypt. But the point of the story is to recognize slavery wherever it exists and whoever is a slave. So, you know, to my mind, it's not only appropriate but necessary to apply it to slavery across cultures and races.
So if you, to do the experiment, go right to Galila's questions. How do you picture the race of those enslaved? How do you think about why they found themselves enslaved? And do you picture that slavery is equivalent to slavery in this country? Those are her three questions.
Well, it was forced labor. So in that sense, it's a very direct equivalent. The Jews were enslaved in order to build the pharaoh's monuments. It feels awfully literal, but again, it's the spirit of it that will ultimately be inspiring. You know, we could split hairs over details. We could look for an archaeological record, but that's not what Martin Luther King was doing when he was referencing the story in that unbelievably moving clip you just played. Mm-hmm. You know, he was referring to the spirit of this perpetual movement toward freedom, the bravery that's required of the leaders and the followers.
And if I could just jump in, I think it's also the idea, part of telling the story, why you know, even, you know, again, there's no comparing there. Those hard things of people try and compare tragedies in this world. But the one thing that you can weigh, which is how we act once we know, I'd say each slavery is a worse slavery in the sense that this story had been told, you know, the weight of slavery and the evil of it has been, you know, told for thousands of years. So every time to re-enslave is, you know, this ignoring of history. That's the whole point here, is to recognize that everybody deserves their freedom. That's why it is a universal story, whatever. And we can feel enslaved in many ways, but that's what this is about, that we all have the right to fight for our liberation. I think this year, you know, that's the idea when you talk about a translation, when, you know, people have asked, and I'm sure it will come up today, about, you know, why not change this, or I like that, or different things to match people's own politics. Politics to the right and to the left. But the point is, when you change something, you can never know what you're changing. But this idea of the word Egypt for the first time, and I don't know how long, like to talk about Egypt as an enslaver in this year where they fought so valiantly, mm-hmm. you know, losing lives, yeah, taking to the streets for liberty. I think even saying Egypt this year has a resonance that just shocks in how it has changed.
But it is interesting in Galila's question how people bring very particular questions to this, and they are urgent questions, and Jewish or not Jewish, to identify with such a powerful story. Sharon in Norfolk, Virginia. Sharon, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to first say thank you for having this show and speaking about this topic. I'm a little emotional. My grandfather raised me. He was a rabbi, and every year he wrote a new Haggadah. And every year in his new Haggadah, he addressed world events and the places where people were not free around the world. And he actually died the second full day of Pesach, and every year we remember him, too, and the way that he came over as an immigrant and where he was not free. The other comment I wanted to make is, in the Haggadah, we address the four sons, and the fourth son is a son who apparently cannot speak at all. He doesn't know the questions to ask, and I just thought that rewriting the Haggadah and adding in more information about the world that we live in really addresses the question of that fourth son who cannot even ask a question. He does not know about the world. He doesn't know enough to even speak. And so we're giving, you're giving life to new voices around the world for someone who doesn't even know what's happening around him.
As a Jew, do you feel an obligation to do that through this holiday and the Haggadah, Sharon?
I feel an obligation every day to do that in every part of my life. I think that part of the Jewish obligation is to live our lives in such a way that we make the world a better place, and that we are models for other people. Whoever needs a model, that we should be able to provide it. And that's really our obligation on earth, and God commands us to do that.
And was your rabbi grandfather, when you say he wrote a new Haggadah every year, was he doing a different translation in effect every year, with looking out around the world to see who needed the attention, who looked enslaved?
He would translate from the traditional text, but he would add in commentary, but much like your guests were talking about, you know, we have a Midrashic tradition in Judaism in which we're always commenting on the original text. And I love the way that your guests suggested that the commentary is really a way to provoke questioning, because questioning is so important in Judaism. You know, it's the opposite educational structure of maybe the standard American. Instead of the teacher asking questions, the students ask the questions, and from that they learn more. You know, their curiosity and their interests guide conversation. And so, you know, in that way, my grandfather was always pulling in new information about the world so that we too could ask, you know, where are people not free? What obligation do we have to this world to make people freer?
Sharon, I appreciate your call and the story of your grandfather's ambition and compassion right there. We're joined by Nathan Englander and Jonathan Safran Foer this hour. They're out with a new translation of the Haggadah, New American Haggadah. You can join us, 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Jonathan Safran Foer and Nathan Englander about their new translation of the great Jewish story of freedom in the Haggadah. Jonathan, Nathan, we have lots of callers. Let's go to Montreal, Canada, and Ahmed. Ahmed, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hello, Tom.
Hi.
Basically, I just want to say, I'm a Muslim. I don't know if your guests are aware, but in Islam, in the Quran, we have the lives of the prophets, and there's a big part of the lives of the prophets, which is the life of the prophet Moses and his birth and getting out of Egypt and after in the desert and all that.
So you know this story from the Quran, Ahmed?
Yes, the whole story. There are some differences. Like, for example, I don't know if the movie that's portrayed in the cinema every year, if that's correct. But in the Quran, for example, the wife of Pharaoh, she's very good, and she's one of the best women in the universe in Islam. She didn't do the stuff that's showing in the movie. I don't know if the Haggadah has the same story as the movie, but yeah, the whole story of Moses and everything is in the Quran.
So what's your question for Jonathan and Nathan?
Do they know about the version of the Quran, and is it different than their version?
First of all, the Pharaoh's wife is in the Bible, but she doesn't appear. You know, that section is not in the Haggadah, though that is an awesome movie. Yul Brynner as Pharaoh cannot be beaten. But no, it's funny that you talk about that, because just separately, this project made me really interested in those connections. I actually just got a Quran at home because I really was suddenly wanted to open out my own mind that way. And I'm really actually personally interested. I can't believe that you mentioned, because it's a personal project. I want to read all those points where the two stories cross, you know, whether it's Abraham or Moses, because I know there's so much common space. But I have, a New Testament at home and a Quran, and I really want to start looking at where things cross.
I wonder how you both think about this, the ownership of this story, how widely felt it is. I mean, you could hear it in Martin Luther King's voice coming at this as a Christian pastor. There you hear Ahmed, very familiar with the story from the Quran. Jonathan, how do you think about the kind of, I don't know if universal is the right word, but very widespread sense of ownership of this story that has the Jewish people at its heart?
Well, it's something that I'm hugely proud of, not as a Jew, but as a human. Mm-hmm. You know, these are the best human values at play, and that we're trying to transmit, you know, from grandparents to parents to children and from generation to generation. So, you know, do I think of it as – I do think of it as my story as a Jewish person, but mm-hmm. I also think of it as my story as a human, and I don't think of my Jewish identity giving me any kind of exclusive claim to it. Not only that, just the opposite, in fact. Like the more it resonates, the more inspiring I find it to be. That was something we really tried to do with this timeline in the book that runs graphically across the top of the pages, is give a real sense of like the breadth of the story, just how impactful it's been on world culture.
And no question it has. Nathan, if you've got it there, I wish you'd read more for us. We just want to keep hearing, so for those who know it well and for those who may not, just to get the sense of the music in it, of your treatment of it. Have you got something for us, Nathan?
Sure, I do. Here goes. And the Lord lifted us out of Egypt, not by the hands of an angel of man, and not by the hands of an angel of light, and not by the hands of a messenger angel, but rather it was done by the Holy One, blessed is He, done by His glorious self and by Himself, as it is said, and I will cross through the land of Egypt on this night, and I will strike every firstborn in the land of Egypt from man to beast, and I, on all the gods of Egypt, will deliver judgment. I am the Lord.
Wow. I mean, there's the heart of the tough stuff here with the Lord, killing every firstborn whose home is not marked with the sign that will make that wrath pass by. What's the commentary that you deliver on that tough part of the Haggadah, Jonathan?
Well, there are four commentaries. The way the commentary works, I should say, is we have four commentators working throughout the book at what are the 10 most pivotal moments, the 10 moments most families like to pause on and look up and say, what's going on here? So Jeffrey Goldberg, the correspondent for The Atlantic, mm-hmm. Writes what we call the nation voice, which is how should Jews as a people examine this story for political values or political questions to be asked. Nathaniel Deutsch, who's a Jewish scholar, writes what we call the House of Study commentary, which appeals more to the sort of stream of Jewish commentary through the ages, and is asking sort of Jewish philosophical questions about the text. We have Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, who's writing what we call the library commentary, which examines the story as a story with characters, with motives and desires, and the fulfillment or not of those desires, and asking what this has to do with us. And finally, Lemony Snicket, who is writing what we call Playground, which is intended for the younger people at the table, maybe 6 to 16, 6 to 20, whatever it is. And so each of those commentators responds to the 10th plague in a different way. But people often ask me, what's my favorite moment of the Haggadah, now that I've spent so many years thinking about it? And what I will often say is that the most fraught moments are my favorite moments, not the moments of great beauty, not the moments that make me that I can feel proud of in a kind of unadulteratedly enthusiastic way, but the really fraught moments, the ones where I don't have an answer, where I have to wrestle with it, and most importantly, where I look forward to the opportunity to sit with my family and discuss them. And the 10th plague is certainly one of those moments.
Well, pick it up then. I mean, here is God Almighty striking down the firstborn in all these homes. I guess leading the Egyptians to see the wisdom of letting his people go. What is the commentary that you're offering here?
Well, I can tell you two different ones. One is Jeffrey Goldberg, who writes about collective punishment. And he traces collective punishment, you know, historically, pausing for some time on World War II, on Dresden and Hiroshima and then Nagasaki, mm-hmm. and asking the question, were those just? You know, is the idea of inflicting harm or death on civilians, on innocent civilians because of the actions of their rulers, can that ever be deemed just? So he doesn't give a prescribed answer, mm-hmm. but that's the question that he builds to and that he wants families to ask. Is there any way of looking at this so that it's just? And then Nathaniel Deutsch, on the other hand, who's mm-hmm. writing from a more Jewish philosophical perspective, talks about the balance of justice and mercy. God's justice and God's mercy and man's justice and man's mercy, and the notion that evil is justice divorced from mercy. And he writes a very provocative, very challenging commentary asking if God's justice was divorced from God's mercy here, and if this is a moment to celebrate or a moment to experience with sadness or even shame.
And with that, you get a sense of the scale and depth of the questions provoked by this ancient story. Shalom in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling. Shalom, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is about a commentary, but I want to make an assumption, which I hope is correct, that the same respect that the speakers, Chag Sameach to you both, giving to the Quran and to the right of Christians, the Easter Sunday is coming,
yes.
believe that when Jesus, Joshua, better known as Jesus, mm-hmm. Pointed at the wine, said, "This is my blood," and then the matzah, "This is my body." The Christians have a right to believe that, and they respect it as much, or including the resurrection. And therefore, my question about the commentator is, which they didn't mention, but I assume that they are familiar with him, because he's considered the greatest of all commentators. I'm speaking of Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, in his comment on the first sentence, God created, in the Torah, he asks the question why the Torah did not start, it's a drash, did not start from Passover, because this was the first commandment to the Jews to observe Passover. And he says, in order to give importance to the fact that God created the world and it's his right to take it away or give it to whoever he chooses. And therefore, the question is, do the speakers have the same respect towards Orthodox Jews who literally believe in the Torah as the promised land, back to Martin Luther King Jr., and in the Rashi as the major greatest of all interpreters? Do they give the same credit, the same respect to the Orthodox Jews to believe what they believe in the promised land as they give to Christians and Muslims to believe in
Shalom, them? Shalom, let us pick it up, and I'll put it right to you, Nathan Englander. That's the culture of your upbringing. What do you say
yes,
to Shalom?
Yes, I was going to – it's a wonderful question, wonderfully asked, and I love me some Rashi. I've referred to Rashi a lot during this translation, but I like the word he chooses because I can't even tell you. It's come up on both directions, and that's the whole point of this thing of a book without agendas, because I love that he uses the word respect, because I feel like there's so much talk about tolerance, and I can't stand tolerance. I don't want to be tolerated. I don't want anyone to tolerate me.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there's something about respect, and that's the point of, you know, why, again, this book – I can't tell you how much this is not our politics, how the obligation, you know, Jonathan's beautiful design idea where the our names are literally supposed to fall off the front. You know, this is not our story. It's our interaction with a story. But that's why it had to be a loyalty to the text, I think, is you know, they're again, I have to say it's a very, very traditional thing. And my family's deeply Orthodox. And I thought about this a lot. And I think our main goal was to just interact with the text itself so that it would just span. So there's room. You know, anyone could not use this Haggadah for any reason. You know, they could not like the design or the commentary or hate my translation or whatever it is. But I wanted there to be room for all Jews within it. And that's an idea, not as a intellectual idea or a tolerant idea, but just, you know, as a book of respect. It was very important to me that my family be able to use it at the table.
Let me go to Barbara in West Roxbury, Massachusetts. Barbara, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm got this Haggadah right in front of me. I'm a rabbi, a Reconstructionist in Boston.
Yes.
And I'm planning to draw from it for my Seder. I think one of the best things that Nathan Englander has done in the promotion of his translation is to teach non-Jews that committed Jews can be committed atheists, too. I think that's very powerful. I love the translations. For the most part, what you read from the Nishmat, which comes from our regular Shabbat liturgy, is probably the most beautiful translation of that prayer I've ever seen. And I've been listening to you talk about not having agendas, and I think you might be able to anticipate what I'm going to ask.
I can totally see it coming. I'm ready.
Yeah, so this is the New American Haggadah. Actually, Mordecai Kaplan wrote the New Haggadah in 1945. We all know there are lots, not just of translations, but different commentaries. But for the past 30 years, we've pretty much put to rest the notion that Avotenu, our fathers, needs to be gender-specific, and that all of Jewish theology understands that despite the gendered nature of Hebrew language, God is not gendered. So what I want to ask you is, what was the conversation you had as you talk about being inclusive and you talk about being for everyone? When I read this, I see it as a male-oriented Haggadah.
Let us pick it up, Barbara. Why do you still have a gendered God here, Nathan?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. And I, you know, back to that idea. I mean, we discussed this, and I discussed it after as this question keeps coming up. We've talked about it, you know, very endlessly. But that, again, this is as my politics, you know what I'm saying? I would go beyond gendered. If you're asking for my politics, I'd go so far. You know what I'm saying? Why even have, let's go gender queer? Like, why not just use the word Z? We should have a, what about the third sex and people who don't identify with any gender or people who want Abraham and Sarah? What about Hagar? Like, there's no, this is not a book of my politics, or there'd be, as Jonathan said, there'd be no slaughter of innocent children. But the point is, I really felt that this is the job of the translator is to illuminate, and it is to, if that illuminates the beauty, as you were very kind about in the text, that's wonderful. But as someone who's left organized religion, if this illuminates problems with Judaic thought, that also is to be discussed. But for a whole story, I just, you know, felt again that it is not for me to edit or adjust, that this is the ancient text in its way. And that was it. It was a fealty to the text. In a sense, it says very clearly the whole story hinges on Moses in the basket, which is, you know, throw the boys into the river and let the girls live. And I just didn't know, once you start unraveling, where to stop, where my politics stop in the unraveling of it. So again, it's a super question, a fair question. And trust me, you know, I'm saying in my life, you know,
may not satisfy Barbara, but I think we understand where you're coming from. And one more, Mark in Cambridge. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Your guest book, The New Haggadah, its release coincides with the publication of Peter Beinart's new book called The Crisis of Zionism, in which he analyzes this sort of a tension now within American Jewry and within Israel between liberalism and Zionism. And it's a kind of impassioned plea for their reconciliation. Liberalism, is, in a certain sense, is an exercise of freedom. Zionism, in a sense, is an exercise of power. And I don't want to imply any polemics or facile analogies, but I did wonder if the guests reflected on the current kind of very morally complex, morally difficult situation in Israel and the story of liberation that they are retelling.
When you have a story of liberation and you have occupation, Jonathan Safran Foer, please speak to that.
Well, I don't know of anybody who doesn't think that that it's a morally simple situation, but there are a lot of different ways of approaching, you know, the complexity. And I think that it's perfectly appropriate to talk about Israel, our relationship as American Jews, as diaspora Jews, to Israeli Jews, to Palestinians as well, at the Seder table. Pretending that there is no issue there is not a way of engaging fully with the Haggadah's demands. The Haggadah is a discomforting document. You know, it's a document that is supposed to, it is not supposed to make us feel comfortable, proud, and happy only, even if it also does those things. It's supposed to awaken us and energize us and activate us. I wouldn't prescribe any particular way of approaching that subject through the Haggadah, but I think that the caller's quite right, that it's hard to imagine an earnest Seder that didn't at least broach the relationship of Jews to the rest of the world. And right now, Israel is where most of the action is happening.
The action and maybe a moral dilemma. Jonathan Safran Foer, Nathan Englander, we're grateful to you, especially in this week, for this work and for your time with us today. Really grateful. And we hope you have good Passovers in your homes. And we hope the message in this ancient text is widely heard and meditated on. Jonathan, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
And Nathan Englander, thank you so much for joining us.
A big treat for me. Thanks.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.